welcome to the EdTech Podcast, the show about all perspectives on education, innovation and technology in and out of the classroom. My name's Sophie Bailey and I'm the founder and host of the show. Welcome to regular listeners and a special hello to any newbies. This week's exciting announcements. First up, the EdTech Podcast announces this week that it will be an official media partnership of South by Southwest Edu. If you're thinking of heading to the show on the 6th to 9th of March in Austin, Texas, you can cash in a $50 listener discount via the South by Southwest Edu website using a special code that I will tweet out and put in the show notes. I'll be out at the festival recording speakers, attendees and exhibitors and generally getting a feel for all things Betsy DeVos, charter schools and coupon schemes and general ed tech. Thanks for all the shout-outs from recent episodes, including John Dooley, a head of IT at Staffordshire Uni, on episode 51 on Can EdTech Save Teachers Time, who said just the episode I've been looking for on his current journey within Academy Trust, and James Hannam, a specialist schools advisor for the DfE, working on a makerspace in Birmingham in the UK on the recent STEAM STEM issue. Stay tuned for more news from Fox, who also got in contact to see if the EdTech Podcast could cover their gala opening of Hidden Figures, the biopic of the scientist behind John Glenn's spaceflight. And finally, thank you to the amazing people out there who offered to cover my lost kit box. I've decided to make do and mend at the moment, but what a lovely lot you are. This week we are treated to an audio cacophony courtesy of angel investor Richard Taylor. This week's opening music is a hat tip to Richard's Australian place of birth and love of the weak version of Marmite, Vegemite. You'll also hear a reference to his last dance in 1998, where I have it on good authority that he was stomped on by a girl at a Mighty Mighty Boss Tunes gig. Now back to the real world. Taylor is like an Aussie Peter Capaldi, for those of you who like In the Thick of It. Alternatively, he's an EdTech version of Vladislav Kirchhoff, Putin's infamous advisor whose reported aim is to undermine people's perception of the world so they never know what is really happening, i.e. his thoughts come through thick and fast. Richard Taylor is an investor in 12 EdTech startups. He dropped out of university, touched upon banking, and then fell into an educational publishing company by chance. In this podcast recording completed at BET, you'll hear what Taylor believes are the three lessons for EdTech success, what he thinks of accelerators, distributors, and teacher pension schemes, and why he thinks part of our latest obsession with coding is a red herring. Strap yourselves in, folks. This one is audio gold. I'm here with Richard Taylor at BET, and it's the end of the first day and we're both pretty exhausted, but I'm ready for an onslaught of profanity, talk about brown shoes and EdTech. So welcome, Richard.
I haven't said fuck yet, so that's pretty good.
I think that was about a 30-second rule there.
Yeah, it was almost as long as the Pearson video that they can't use.
Yeah, the infamous Pearson video. So, Richard, for the sake of our listeners who don't know you...
Well, I don't really do anything if I can help it. I'm very lazy, really. I've been investor in about 12 EdTech startups, some of which are still going, or most of which are still going. One or two have gone broke. I fell into education completely accidentally. When I left school, I was a jackaroo, went to university and dropped out because I didn't like it. I was a bit too, thought I was too smart, probably wasn't. Worked in banking and funds management for a while and happened to fall into education because I met some friends of my wife's, and my wife ran an education, big educational publishing company. So it's a long story. I've been doing it for over 20 years now. I do it to make money, so I'm often seen as one of the guys with the black hat. I get, you get a lot of stick about that, but I'm fairly used to it. But I quite enjoy it, and I think I know a reasonable amount about it, but my views are often a bit contrarian because I'm not a parent, I'm not an educator, and as someone famously said, I'm too stupid to spell pedagogy, but I can read a balance sheet.
So the thing is, so... there's always like this 6 degrees of separation or whatever they call it. But so from people I've met, everyone's always like, you need to speak to Richard Taylor, you need to speak to Richard Taylor. And so the point is that I think people respect your opinion because of those investments, like you said, a lot of them are still going and EdTech doesn't have perhaps a great success rate. And, you know, any startup, was it 1 in 10 goes forward if you believe these things?
It could be 1 in 10, but the reality is, and I always say, I mean, EdTech, what I do isn't fancy. it's gambling. Mm-hmm. It's just that if you're a professional gambler, you think you can sort of work out what the odds are a bit better than the mug punters. And the reality is that investing in early stage ed tech startups, which I do, it's like a horse race, only the horse race takes 7 years to even know who might have won the race, and half of them you have to take out and shoot at year two. So it's nothing, you know, if you strip it away, it's nothing more sophisticated than that. And when I first started doing stuff in education, I didn't really care about what it was or whether it had any impact. If it made money, that was all I really cared about. And sometimes you make money, but actually the better lesson is when you lose money. And actually, I reflected on what I'd been doing a few years ago and thought the things that are more likely to be successful are the ones that have a teacher in the founding team, are trying to do something slightly substantive, and it's not the sort of schlocky shit stuff, that which I think is about 90% of edtech. And it's quite difficult because I think a lot of edtech doesn't work. I think that anything that's publicly procured should have to have an open data API, so the independent researchers can at least try and work out whether it makes any difference. Because when schools buy or use edtech, there's a financial cost, but a big opportunity cost. Mm-hmm. And I see lots of stuff that's fairly well regarded that I think is complete shit when it comes to, does it really work? You know, does it deliver anything that's credible educationally? Does it help teachers and does it help kids? If it doesn't do those things, it's never going to work. And you're probably never going to make any money out of it.
It's an interesting one as well because, I mean, there's this whole efficacy debate. And the fact is that even if you invest £100,000 in an efficacy study, you know, which takes an incredibly long amount of time and resource, you're still, if you listen to people like Dr. Rose Luckin at UCL, it's still very hard to actually pinpoint, is that applicable? You know, can you take out context from all of your study?
Rose Luckin is probably one of the smartest people in UK education, but we'd probably disagree about how to do research. So I was in the EU thing a while ago, and I was saying, I think research and education should be on the model of Roland Fryer and his team at Harvard University, which when they do research, it happens very quickly. Mm. Some of it doesn't take more than a year, because a lot of education research takes up to 7 years, and they're trying to get perfection in how they do the model and do all the recruit the people and all this sort of stuff. And in 7 years' time, none of the people who are in schools, either students or teachers, are there anymore.
And the iPhone could have come out in that time and completely disrupted everything.
And Roland Fryer's idea is you do it fairly quickly so it can be implemented fairly quickly. And I was at this EU event and I was sort of saying, I think that this is one of the big problems in research in education and education tech particularly. And one of the people who was there, who was a very senior and sort of, you know, well-known education researcher, said, I hope you're not proposing that we do quick, dirty research. And I said, fucking right, that's exactly what I'm saying. That's what we should do more of. And she almost fell over. And the problem is, I saw a piece of research only a week ago that was a major story in the BBC about an education app. I'm not going to say which one it was, done by one of the top two universities in the UK. And actually, when you read the research, what the BBC wrote was fundamentally wrong. It was cherry-picking research results and taking something that's insignificant and pretending that that was actually a significant thing. And I think there's a real issue, because the thing that kills most edtech companies isn't having a bad product, mm-hmm. it's not having enough money, all those things are tough, it's distribution and procurement. Schools buy millions of pounds worth of stuff, pretty much like the local football club buy their sausage rolls for the fundraising night. And it's a disaster, and that to me is one of the crucial things in education. And oddly enough, the DfE set up a thing called the Centre for Procurement Performance several years ago. And I remember someone telling me that the metric for success for the guy who ran it was how many staff he had, not whether schools had saved one cent or done anything better. And this is where I think Tom Bennett and his ruck with Minecraft and a lot of the people in the edtech community is quite true. There is a cost directly and an opportunity cost for every piece of tech you use in education. And if you don't think about that carefully, you just end up with a whole lot of crap that we've got in schools now that teachers don't use.
Very interesting. And I mean, you mentioned you're in it for the money, but at the same time, if you wanted to make money, you could make it a lot easier. So why?
No, after all these years, I'm too stupid to know anything else. I've got to focus on what I do. If I had to learn something else, you know, I haven't got another 20 years.
And so you also mentioned your assignment report. So I know that's, you know, that's sold on now and that kind of thing. But what was the kind of story behind that, and how did you get the actual data and the tracking going?
It's pretty simple. When I first came here, I worked at the DfE Business Development Unit, which was a run under contract by Edcom, so it was a really great thing. They did some really interesting stuff. But it was very frustrating because education's a big business. There were no publications about it. It was hard to get information about the private sector people we were trying to do things with policy teams. And when I left, I thought, this is ridiculous. So I just set the assignment report up, started writing it myself. My first two subscribers were Tim Pearson from RM and Marjorie Scardino, or now Dame Marjorie Scardino, who was running Pearson. And I wrote the stuff that interested me. It was probably absolute crap, if I'm honest. The only thing that made it sellable was the fact that my wife started her career as an editor and she could turn my drivel into something that was actually people would pay for. And it gave you the opportunity to talk to lots of interesting people. And you think you know a lot about stuff, and then you get into education and you realise you know very little. So that was how it started. I sold it after about 2 or 3 years to Ed Tranum from MySone, and it's now been going for 10 years. Oddly enough, I still use it on a daily basis because it's got 10 years of really useful information. Most of the subscribers are investors and banks and people like that, because it's quite expensive. And oddly enough, it comes out in a low-tech format, which is a PDF that you get in your email for subscribers. You can look at all the stuff on the website, but I don't think anybody does. People print it out, stick it in their bag, and read it when they have time. Because senior decision makers are time poor. They don't spend time on the internet. You know, it's one of those really weird things. But one of the things I did...
That's really interesting that you mentioned that, because I know when they launched the TES app, teachers used the app, and the school leaders used the subscription model still, the hard copy magazine.
Well, it's one of these things. I think one of the tough things in education, and edtech particularly, is teachers don't have much voice. And I ran a program with Cambridge Assessment, part of Cambridge Uni, called EdInvent, trying to get to change the voice of educators in edtech. It was 50% a success and 50% a really screaming failure. And the screaming failure was getting teachers out of school to come to events. But the ideas educators come up with when you talk to them and try and say, here's the world of edtech, here are some of the bits that you don't know about, particularly some of the history, because so much stuff you hear in edtech is recycled bullshit. It's like freemium. The first freemium edtech product was almost 200 years ago here in London. It was Pitman Shorthand, developed by Sir Isaac Pitman, who was an ex-teacher, had his own school. It was published using sponsorship, and it was distributed through the internet of the day, which was Universal Penny Post, and it kicked off pretty much the whole correspondence education movement, which was a huge part of the whole education sort of system outside schools up until probably the 1970s. So when you hear people say, oh, freemium's all new, it's absolute crap. It's been around for 200 years. You know, teacherpreneurs have been around for that long. You know, the first MOOC was in the 1950s in America at the University of Champaign-Urbana called Plato.
Well, it's funny you said that about, you know, regurgitating things that have actually been going for ages, because today I moderated this session and I had this live voting thing and I put up a quote. One was from Shakespeare and As You Like It, and one was from Plato, The Republic. So it's just trying to get people to recognise the fact that, you know, we like to think these progressive versus traditional arguments are new, but they're not. They've been rumbling on for...
Look, I've got this stuff about coding, eons, which I think is a complete heap of shit in schools and a complete waste of time for most kids, because most schools, in the UK at least, are doing it as a tick box exercise for Ofsted. Actually, my great hero in technology and education technology is a woman, Rear Admiral Grace Hopper, who invented the term bug. She was an ex-academic at Harvard and Vassar, worked with the US Navy on the first computers during the Second World War. And she was really keen on computers, but much more so on computational literacy. I mean, she retired as the oldest serving officer in the US Navy at 82. The women's group at Microsoft are called the Hoppers. There's a professorship of computer science at Harvard that's named after her. And yet 90% of the people in the startup zone in this whole place today wouldn't have a clue who Grace Hopper was. And yet she's one of the most significant women in technology ever. But half the people here would know about Ada Lovelace, Byron's daughter, who frankly isn't fit to lick Grace Hopper's bootlaces. And yet we're going to have Ada Lovelace academies. But, you know, so that's why I think so much of stuff that happens in education and edtech, having some grey hair and knowing a little bit about it is actually quite important, because you get spun stuff so often. And it's not that I've just seen it before, but a lot of the stuff is just based on often fairly just weak thinking. And to someone who said, oh, look, I've got this great idea for something to do with maths or something to do with English. Now, you've only got to look at Knight Zookeeper, who were one of my early investments, they've been around for about 6 years now. They're a classic example. It's a great product. It's deeply educational. Educator in the founding team. But they've been living like poor students for 6 years now. And to be in edtech, I always say it's like being, you know, if you want to be a successful edtech entrepreneur, your closest job description is being a Hell's Angel in an outlaw motorcycle gang, because they call themselves one percenters. Well, to be a successful edtech entrepreneur, you've got to be a one percenter. You've got to give up your nice flat. You've probably got to give up your relationship. You give up eating at nice places like Nando's becomes upmarket food, and McDonald's is probably more likely, or Iceland will be your usual shopping. You give up, you know, holidays, pensions, all that stuff. They're for normal people, and that's for a minimum of 5 years. If you can do that, you might survive, and your product might work.
You might upgrade to, like, KFC, if you're lucky.
Yeah, well, yeah, you know, it's always good to eat a bit of fried cat every now and then.
Yeah.
But if you can't do it for 5 years, don't be a bloody edtech entrepreneur. Stay in education or stay doing something else, because if you can't hack it, piss off, you're not going to get the money from people like me.
So, I mean, the interesting one, so you've got people like Matt Robb at EY Parthenon, and, you know, his thing is edtech isn't a thing because the monetary value isn't there that he's seen on the scale that he would recognise a thing to be. My question to you was, what are probably the most successful by revenue edtech companies out there? What are the kind of some of the top?
Well, I'll give an example. One of my favourite ones is Study Ladder in Australia. It's traditionally free. It's primary school content, free during the school day, and you pay outside. 2 years ago, they made $2 million EBITDA, which is earnings before interest, tax, and all the other bullshit, which on a small company like that, in a market like Australia, is really good. The really fascinating thing with them is it can't be free for American schools anymore, because all the American schools want to sign on with Clever, a single sign-on, and Clever charged them $1,000 a school, so they can't give it away now. They've got to charge the schools $1,000. So they're a great example. I think, you know, companies in the UK like Show My Homework, they confounded everybody by doing the old-fashioned flogging it by getting appointments in schools and going and seeing it. Great product, great team, really, you know, but they did it the hard way. Whereas lots of people go, oh, I need a distributor, all that stuff. Distributors screw you 90% of the time. If your distributor is not going to put $100,000 into the pot every year, they're just going to, you'll be one of lots of products and you'll get no traction with them. So it's those sorts of companies. Twig are doing well, but it takes a long time. And you've got to have patient investors. You've got to be prepared to stick at it. And you're not going to get the big multiples because people mistake education as being one big market. It's a whole lot of micro markets. You've got England, you've got Wales, you've got Scotland, you've got private schools, you've got individual countries in Europe. Virtually every edtech company and education company I've seen from the UK who's gone to America has completely screwed it up because they don't understand how hard it is to sell to school districts, how in most states in America, schools are funded from property tax, except in California and a few other places. And cracking those markets is, or even attempting to crack those markets has been the rock upon which most UK education companies have broken themselves.
What do you think about this coupon idea? Have you heard about this in the US where the parents get given coupons to choose which schools to go to? But I mean, if you're skint, you're not going to be able to travel halfway across the country.
It's not a new idea. In some ways, I really like the idea. Mm-hmm. It's about school choice. I think the UK system is really quite weird because it's this whole thing about private schools are all it's about class warfare, and I think the UK is just, it's quite badly served by that argument. I come from Australia where almost 40% of kids go to private schools. My two nephews, one of them has spent the last 6 years at a private school where the fees are £3,000 a year and the government tip in the rest. And the only real difference is that it's in a little country town. There's a high school over the road where when I went there you had less than 1% chance of starting in year 7 and graduating in year 12. His school over the road get a lot more kids through, although unfortunately my nephew, who's a lazy little bugger, screwed it all up. But the school has the ability to say if you screw around, they just kick you out.
And what was your own schooling like?
Well, I went to school in a whole lot of places and grew up in the city and in the country. I somehow lucked out and got a scholarship to this weird old-fashioned military boarding school in Melbourne, where when I went there, I think there were more automatic weapons in the school armoury than there were kids. I mean, but you've got to remember, I went there in 1979, which makes me very old, and Australia had conscription until 1975 because we were fighting the Vietnam War. So it's not like the CCF here, which is sort of military light. We were full-on sort of a week with the army every year, every Thursday afternoon, all that sort of stuff.
So you did all of that as well?
Yeah, and frankly, they didn't really care whether you could read or write, as long as you could play sport and
shoot
do
again.
Cadets. Well, I spend most of my time shooting. There aren't many people in education who are going to say that they do, but you know, I'm quite good at it. I've done it since I was a little kid.
So do you do it now? So you do it for enjoyment, so country shooting, is that right?
I got a house in the country. I'm in a syndicate. I do quite a lot of game shooting, but I only shoot stuff I eat.
Oh, okay, that's good.
Yeah. You know, I just think...
You've got to make sure you get the shot out.
Well, no, you should be able to tell. So the great thing is, the real Downton Abbey houses 100 years ago, you could tell if they ate a lot of game because it all sat in the bottom of the toilet and didn't flush away.
All the game shot.
That's yeah, so all the shot would just sit, because it's lead, it just sort of...
So I grew up on the Isle of Wight, and our next door neighbours were these amazing old couple. They're both gone now, from Yorkshire, and you'd go over there and you'd be this tiny kid, and then invariably there would always be like pheasants or rabbits hanging up.
Yep.
And it'd just be sort of semi-terrifying entry into their house, but yeah.
The thing is, I grew up shooting when I was a little kid. I went to this weird school where we did a lot of this stuff. When I finished school, about a third of kids went to university, a third went back onto the land to be farmers of some sort, and I went to be a jackaroo, which is like a sort of apprentice cowboy, and about a third went to the military. It's not like that anymore. That sort of stuff doesn't exist. But yeah, I've shot all my life. When I worked in the outback, I can still remember we were about 400 miles from the nearest town. You couldn't go to the shops. There was, you know, unless the doctor came, which was a flying doctor in a real emergency. If it was a couple of stitches or something, that they weren't going to come. We used to get, the only vegetables we had came in on the road train probably once a month, and it was like cans of peas and beans and stuff like that. So it's a completely different lifestyle than it is now. This one of the places I worked on was over 1 million acres.
Wow, that's mad.
So my background is completely different. Well, not completely different than everyone in education.
It's quite unusual, yeah.
It just means I look at things, and I think actually not being a university graduate and not looking at things with a whole lot of preconceived ideas is quite helpful. And you were asking about Parthenon and all the consultants who work in this area. I think one of the weaknesses they have is, if I'm honest, a little bit of groupthink, because they've all got advanced degrees and MBAs and things like that. And I always find that when I deal with consultants and people with MBAs, you can give them 100 different problems and they all come up with the same answer because they put it through the same models all the time. I always think it's flexibility of thinking that's the answer to lots of problems, not just trying to put it through pre-existing models that they taught you in graduate school.
And can you be tempted by any other edtech investments?
Oh, look, I'm always open to something, but as I said to you earlier, I'm not really an early stage investor, which embarrasses my wife when I say this. I'm a conception investor. I'm normally there when the sperm meets the egg 9 months before the real business is there. I mean, you know, Nike Zookeeper.
So is that whole idea of liking and buying into the leadership team as opposed to?
It's that, but it's also not having enough money to do it later. So a lot of people who invest in edtech probably do it for the wrong reasons, like in lots of early stage investing, because if you're a high income earner and you chuck some money into one of these companies, you're often better off if they go tits up and go broke fairly quickly, because you get a whole lot of tax benefits rather than waiting for the 7 years until they might make some money or get sold or do something interesting. And also, in a way, if you do what I do, you can get in for small amounts of money, 5 and 10 grand to do, and you get a bit of leverage there, whereas later on you can put 100 grand in and not get very much. The perverse thing is that if you're the first investor in the door, you're often you're the best friend for about 6 months, and then they completely forget about you when they do their second round of fundraising and people come in and put a couple of 100 grand in. It feels uncomfortable, and sometimes it really irritates me, but it's a sort of natural thing. But when you've got a couple of companies, you know, you can spread the risk and you can do little bits for them. Because frankly, really what investors bring, a good investor, it's not about it's about the money, but it's also about what you can do beyond the money. And a lot of investors don't really do much beyond the money. The ones who do are great. The flip side of that is a lot of companies don't really know how to get the most out of their investors. You know, I think you need to get them together occasionally over a drink or a cup of coffee or something like that, because there's lots of stuff they could do, but that you haven't really asked them to do.
And just what comes out in conversation.
Yeah, all that sort of stuff. And it's also, I think, having an opinion. I think it's a disaster in this industry not to be able to have an opinion. I mean, lots of people, like, I can talk under concrete, but most people get the sense of what I'm saying fairly quickly. I hate it when you go to things and it's like this bullshit bingo where they say all the buzzwords about gamification and blended learning and 21st century skills. And I come away thinking, what the fuck have we just talked about? I don't really understand. And I figure if I don't understand, I'm not particularly smart, but if I don't understand, how are other people going to understand? And there's so much of that in education and edtech.
It's interesting what you're saying, because you're talking about basically mentorship and offering that support. And then, you know, there's a whole raft of accelerators out there. And I think, you know, you have an opinion on those as well.
Accelerators can be great. I think most of them are like, you know, accelerators are a bit like arseholes. You know, everyone's got one and most of what comes out is shit. And that's the reality, because even there are only a few I've seen in the world that specialize in education. Only a couple of those I think are any good. You know, Emerge has done a really great job here, but I think they still haven't quite done what I think an EdTech accelerator could do. But I really respect Jan, and the stuff they've done is really significant, and you know, you can't take anything away from them for that. But my favorite accelerator in the world is 4.0 Schools in New Orleans, which is sort of pre-accelerator program. Almost every one of their alumni went on to win Startup Weekend and get into all sorts of other accelerators. But it's got to be specific about education. It's got to be disciplined. I mean, I think Emerge are probably there now. They weren't when they started, like any incubator. Night Zookeeper went through Waira. It was great for them, but I think it was too generalist. And there are lots of accelerators. There are a couple of good ones in Boston. There's a new one being set up in Cape Town.
And you were saying you kind of keep an eye on things that come out of Boston in terms of...
Look, I think the three places I think are quite interesting is Austin, Boston, and New Orleans. The stuff from New Orleans, you know, they had the worst education system in America for God knows how long. And after Katrina, they just started again. 90% of the schools are charter schools who are like free schools. Actually, some of those are now coming back under sort of a degree of local authority control, because there's this whole, you know, the Naomi Klein book about, you know, how it's a sort of right-wing takeover of education when you do stuff like that. And to a degree, maybe she's right. But actually, what's been really interesting in the last year is there's been a movement in New Orleans to bring some of the charter schools back under a small degree of sort of centralized authority. And the idea being, yeah, we needed outsiders to come in to really do this stuff, because actually you've got to be pretty poisonous and make a lot of enemies. And actually, maybe now it's time to sort of move on and do it in a slightly different way. But I don't get a sense of that here in the UK. And frankly, I don't know whether anyone's actually alive at the DfE who can actually spell EdTech or strategy anymore. You tell me there are, and apparently there have been some events that, obviously, because I'm a bit gobby, they don't invite me to them. But, you know, in a way, they've got an important role to play. And I think they've seeded this, unfortunately, partly for political reasons. But I also think that there's this big issue that politicians make decisions about what happens in education, and that's a pain in the ass, because, you know, they just change things for sort of stupid reasons, like this whole idea of grammar schools at the moment. That, and even I think it's a sort of cock of shit in a hat. But Theresa May seems to want to go with it. But, you know, what happens next is politicians make decisions, but then it's up to bureaucrats to implement these things. And frankly, most bureaucrats don't know a lot about education, even in the departments these days, because, you know, they've been on a fast track. They're all sort of super brainy Oxford graduates who can do crosswords backwards underwater. But it does. But translating that knowledge, you know, that braininess and what politicians want into pragmatic things that might work in classrooms for teachers, for kids, seems to be a sort of impossible dream at the moment. And I do think that there is a lot more needs to be done, or could be done, helping civil servants understand things like EdTech, so that they'll stop making boneheaded decisions. I mean, we had, you know, curriculum online. It was a great idea. It built up the industry. And then we had BBC Jam that scared every investor in a way and was closed down after wasting, you know, over £100 million. There's been so much disjointed thinking. And I would say we've wasted billions of pounds here. I mean, £600 million for interactive whiteboard, VLEs and interactive whiteboards that, you know, nobody ever really used or in any significant way, or
and
very
time
few teachers.
As well, because these arguments have been going on for a decade or more.
Exactly. The UK 30 years ago was a leader in EdTech, as was Victoria and Australia. You have a change of government, you have a change of priority, and suddenly it all goes off the boil. And then 30 years later, you have BBC Micro. I mean, you know, BBC Micro is, I think, the wrong answer to the question in EdTech at the moment. It's been developed by a great company, Technology Will Save Us, who I love, but I don't think that's the solution for kids and what they might need to be able to do in the future.
What do you think about student-teacher ratio and things like, I learned yesterday, 25 million people born in India every year. So in 3 years, 2 to 3 years, that's the size of the UK. And then what in terms of teachers and how to actually
look, I'm not an educator. I've looked at this as an outsider, but there's I've yet to see much compelling evidence that links class numbers with outcomes. I'm sure there are.
Well, this is what they also said, that in China the class sizes are double, but they get half of their time to develop CPD and their own planning.
Yeah, but there's a big issue here. How much time do they actually spend in class? There's that TV program about South Korean education recently. They spent just a shitload long at school every day, and it's not 180 days a year. It's probably 230 or 240 days a year. I think in most countries in the world, education is 50% education, 50% childcare, if you're lucky. Because without that, Western economies can't operate. You know, people need to go out and work, and you can't have the kids at home. Traditionally, so you had to have them somewhere, and school was quite a good place to have that.
Yeah.
And you look at all the stuff that schools are meant to deliver now, you know, from all the PHESC stuff, and the latest thing I saw today was teaching kids how to wash their hands. You know, it's all important stuff, but actually, you know,
you didn't have to worry about that when you're shooting guns.
Well, you have to worry about it, but for different reasons. But it just seems to me that teachers don't have enough time. They're expected to do too much. However, the flip side of this, and it'll make me incredibly unpopular with teachers, is I think a lot of young teachers manage their time terribly. I was talking to Oliver Quinlan, who used to be at Nestor and is now at Raspberry Pi, who, when he was an early teacher, was spending 80 hours a week and said to his head teacher, I'm going to burn out. And the head teacher said, well, you'll burn out unless you learn to manage your time. And I was tweeting with Tom Bennett about this because I was at a conference about teacher workload recently and whether tech can make any difference. And I asked Tom, and he said, actually, no, he doesn't think there's any teacher training course in the UK that has time management as one of it. And frankly, the most valuable thing teachers have is their time, and they shouldn't be cocking around, wasting their time. They have to be laser-like. They've got to be... Teachers are like surgeons. They need to make every minute count, and all this stuff that's irrelevant, just piss it off. EdTech has made an impact on that, but much more on the administrative side rather than on the teaching side yet. But teachers still don't quite get that actually their time, every teacher's time, is as valuable as a doctor or a surgeon or a nurse. And those people have to manage their time incredibly carefully, as do teachers. Yeah, there's a whole lot of bureaucratic bullshit that you've got to sort of deal with anyhow, and it's a pain in the ass. But everybody does that, whether you're a teacher, whether you're in the private sector, and you know, wherever you work these days. But you have to manage your time. I mean, I'm the worst person to talk about this because I'm, you know, if I don't have a nap in the afternoon, I think I have an unsuccessful day. You know, and I probably read 5 books a week, you know.
I had a couple of questions, one about books. But the first one, so who are some of your favourite investors?
Well, I don't know. I don't really worry about what other investors do.
Investment decisions?
Yeah, my favourite investors are Ontario Teachers' Pension Plan. And frankly, every teacher in this country should have their pension managed by them, not by the great Ponzi scheme, which is the pension scheme for teachers in England and Wales, which I really think is a Ponzi scheme.
So it's not like all the Silicon Valley people, it's the ones in that, yeah.
Ontario Teachers' Pension Plan was set about 26 years ago. The first 25 years, their average return on investment was over 10%, so only second to Warren Buffett probably in America. There's only about 330,000 teachers in Ontario they manage the pensions for. They've got £90 billion in assets. They own the national lottery here. They've got their own private equity company. They're hugely, in education, they're probably the most successful investor in the world. And they're investing teachers' pensions from Ontario, a province of Canada. You know, we've got a system here with about 1.2 million in the teachers' pension scheme here. It's got, in theory, I think £170 billion in it. Only it's an accounting entry. There's no real money and no real assets. They pay teachers' pensions pretty much out of current contributions. I know that that's changing substantially. But to me, it's not Bill Gates and all those people. Or you know, I mean, I love Learn Capital in America with what they do. And there are a few investors around. Deborah Quozzo from GSV, you know, those sorts of investors, and there are some good ones here in the UK. DC Thompson, you know, patient long-term capital, but I don't really focus on them very much. You know, I just worry about my own little micro investments.
And how about books then? Do you have any books that would have a big impact on you, even when you were at school? Or
business books are complete bollocks. I think I'm always telling my wife not to read them, and she reads lots of them. I think They're like a cargo cult.
They're kind of like self-help books, like the worst type of self-help books.
Yeah, exactly. They just pandered all our gross insecurities, and we all have them. I just sort of try and hide mine by reading lots of crime novels, particularly the old classic ones. I think in terms of business books, I studied marketing at university for 4 years and dropped out. I learnt more in 4 hours reading one book than I learnt in 4 years, which probably meant I was a crap student. And it was called The 10 Immutable Laws of Marketing, written by Al Reis and Jack Trout back in the 1970s. And I used to make everyone who worked for me read that book because it's got some great lessons in it. And one of my favourite ones used to be about, I think it was Avis the Rent-A-Car Company, and their whole marketing pitch was, we're number two, so we try harder, and everyone thought they were the underdog. They were the biggest car rental company in the world, but by miles.
Oh, and they just use that as a...
Yeah, and it was a great thing. I can remember going to the airport thinking, I'll go with these guys because they're the underdog. You know, so it's stuff like that. Someone asked me today, I think it was today or yesterday, you know, what's the best business thing that you've ever been taught? And I always say to people, learn to read upside down. The number of meetings I go into where there's something a bit tricky you've got to sort out, and the person on the other side of the table has it all printed out on A4 in 14 point, I can read it upside down before they've even told me what the problem is.
Well, it's like in the media, it happens all the time when they're taking photos of a government minister with their paperwork and then zoom in and...
Yeah, it's not... a lot of the stuff they teach at business school probably is really useful. Probably. I mean, I've yet to see much of it that really is.
And so do you think higher education will just... demise in its current form then? Because
it's not going to go away anytime soon. I think it's got a lot of challenges. I wonder whether there was a great book called Shopcraft to Soulcraft by Matthew Crawford in America, and he goes through the whole American education system, gets his PhD and realizes he thinks it's a crock of shit for him, and sets up a motorcycle repair shop and gets much more satisfaction out of it, and I think earns more money. And part of his argument is, you know, we've completely lost this idea of doing practical things. You know, we do lots of theoretical things. And I think part of his argument is that tradesmen and tradeswomen or tradespeople, whatever the hell you call them these days, may become for some time the highest paid people. I mean, my accounting bill went from $5,000 to £500 a year when I put it on, I think it was Freelancer or something like that.
Yeah.
And I would never recommend anyone become a lawyer or an accountant at the moment. It's like coding. You know, learning to code is great right now. You can earn great money coding. And it's, you know, that and computer science and data science are great high-value careers. But in 15 years' time, I think a lot of coding or the stuff that kids are learning in schools now would only equip you to do digital burger flipping. Mm. I mean, computational thinking, yeah, it's going to be hugely important. But there was a company last year, Viv.ai. It was done by the guys who did Siri. And it was chatbot technology, which I think could be huge in education. No one really talks about it.
Web Summit, yeah.
And so with Viv, he gives a demonstration where he says, how hot will it be on the north side of the Golden Gate Bridge at 2 o'clock tomorrow afternoon? Really complex question. Siri would sort of have a conniption trying to work it out and send you to the local coffee shop. It uses natural language processing in 1/100 of a second. It works out what your intent is. It then writes the program. So in this case, it wrote a 75-step program to answer it. And in under 1/2 a second, it answers the question with a high degree of accuracy. And I spoke to the guys who did it, and I said, what's the application in education? And they said, well, it could be really huge, but it depends on who comes to us and what they're prepared to offer. That company was sold to Samsung in October last year. Launched in March, sold in October. God knows for how much, because it's been undisclosed. That, you know, you've already got self-writing software. So in 15 years' time or 10 years' time when kids in schools, or maybe 15 years' time when they go into whatever the workforce will be, and it probably won't be all that much different in some ways than it is now, even though we imagine it will be. Knowing how to write a bit of Scratch or a bit of Logo or any of those things, unless it's developed a really good base for computational literacy, will be, I think, completely irrelevant. I think computational literacy will become like reading and writing and maths. I think it'll be a very fundamental literacy. But the stuff that we're doing in schools, mostly with coding, I don't really see that those sort of skills are being developed. I'm happy to be wrong, and with most of these things, I often am, but I just don't really see it. I think for kids, learning a foreign language will develop similar sorts of critical thinking and the same sorts of skills. And if you can translate that into computation literacy, then it's probably far more useful. But right now, we will go through this sort of next bullshit wave of coding in schools. people will do it because there's an Ofsted requirement and they'll do it in a minimalist way. Some schools will do it brilliantly. Lots of charities and people like Code Club are doing fantastic stuff. But fundamentally, they're about computation literacy. The coding is just, you know, it's just a way to do it. It's the grammar and what's, you know, it's the letters and the grammar. It's and the language and the Shakespeare of coding and of computation literacy is based on those letters and grammar. But it's the words and how you use them that create sort of outcome at the end. And we're not thinking like that in schools. At least it's sort of a segue back to your Shakespeare metaphor of yes. several minutes ago.
Well, Richard, that's enough for now, but I definitely think we should do more of this because it was extremely good fun.
Well, I'm sure you'll probably have to be doing a lot of bleeping out and get lots of complaints.
Absolutely not. No bleeping.
I was going to say, you know, in one of my old businesses, I used to get so many death threats that all the sort of people who hate me now can just join the queue, kind of piss on my grave later on.
Well, I think, you know, it means that you're doing something right because you're getting people's opinions out there, so...
Well, I think your podcast is doing something right. I'm not a big fan of podcasts, and it's the only one I've actually ever listened to. I've listened to three of them now, so you must be
Which
doing
ones
something.
Which did you listen to?
Particularly the one that really sticks in my mind was the guy from the school who was the head of tech who'd been a teacher.
Dominic Norrish.
Yeah, and talking about how most stuff is just never going to work in schools. And I think he's right.
You guys need to meet. You've got a lot in common.
we probably have a lot, but you know, he's a proper educator. You know, I wouldn't understand most of the stuff he's going to start talking about. Using, you know, pedagogy and heuristics and all those sort of words, I have to get a dictionary or go into Google to try and understand, you know.
So that was Dom, and then the other two.
I can't remember because I always listen to them while I'm doing something else.
You should listen to, there's Dave Faulkner, who's a fellow Australian. So he was a principal, I think, by the time he was 24, and he was in the Outback.
How can you be the principal of a school at 24? I mean, honestly, I didn't lay my ass from my elbow.
He was in the Outback as well, so they basically needed anyone. Not that it was anyone, but, and as a result, his story is that, you know, it forced him to really grow very quickly in that role.
Oddly enough, the first MOOC I ever used was the School of the Air. Massive open online course in Australia delivered by this funny technology called radio. I mean, the really weird thing is the first proposal for the Open University came from J.C. Stobart, who I think was the first director of education at the BBC, and he wanted a wireless university in 1926. That's why so much of the stuff that we're seeing here today...
using technology to transmit ideas.
And in fact, someone said to me yesterday, it shouldn't be called EdTech, it should just be called education.
Yeah, exactly. Banking is not called mobile banking anymore.
Yeah, it's not called... Well, there is fintech, but actually fintech is just banking or finance or insurance under another name. Mm. And I think maybe, actually, is EdTech past its use-by date? Maybe, but I think it's going to be around for a long time yet.
Yeah, it's just an easy catch-all term, isn't it?
It has
its issues, for sure.
Look, and I think it has some real drawbacks. It actually should just be... It's about education. It's about... If it works for a student or works for a teacher, then it works and you might have backed the right horse in the race. If it doesn't, you know, like any gamble, you've picked the wrong horse, you've done your dough, you know, you're slightly screwed, go home and cry about it and hopefully, you know, you've got enough to pay the bills next week.
Yeah.
You know, that's the way it works in EdTech.
Well, on that note, enjoy your martinis and we shall reconnect soon, I'm sure.
I may see you here on Friday if I make it back.
Okay. Thank you, Richard.
All right.
Thanks very much for listening, everyone. Do tweet your feedback or post to the Facebook page so I can share with the community. And if you like this episode, do me a favour and share with a friend. Have a great week!
From and made so many problems to crack and miles to fade. Crooked was the math and brazen was the walk. A cocky swagger up the ladder, and could he ever talk? Last around, I'd do it again. The rascal came behind the bars of the bar in front of them. Last around, I'd do it again.